Well, my name is Mike. We're talking today about money, which I enjoy talking about. Love what I do. Founder and started Kronos Wealth. I've been a wealth management advisor for over a decade now. And a little bit of my background, I grew up in a Christian home. I was talking with Sam here. He's interning for us this year. Could not have asked for better upbringing in life. Parents that love the Lord modeled that, church every Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, anytime the doors are open. And grandparents were church planners, mom and dad, Christian ministry. Then my dad became an attorney and just could not have asked for better upbringing in life. So a little background about myself. I'm kind of a serial entrepreneur. Started several businesses, landscaping, tree climbing company. So on the weekends, I still like climbing. So if you see some kid up really high, that might be me. Then we run our Awana program at our church, and I've got three beautiful little kids, been married 11 years now, and are 5, 2, and 1. So we are in the thick of it. So a little bit of background about myself. We are going to talk about money today and just the idea of getting comfortable with the topic of money. We as Christians don't like to talk about it too much. We're going to talk about it today. Shifting the paradigm, the mentality, the idea around wealth, why do we talk about it? Why should we or why shouldn't we? How can we actually get comfortable around it and just change our mindset around it? And then lastly, more takeaways from today, whether it's for laypersons, I had to pick a term, so we're just going to call laypersons, or pastors, takeaways for both of you guys just as far as specific ways that you can really impact ministry and yourselves in some positive ways. So without further ado, show me the money. Let's get comfortable with the topic of money. It's funny, if you read through the Bible, money is talked about so much, either as a subject itself or it's used as a teaching tool or an analogy, allegory, parable. 10% of the verses in the Gospels deal with money, talk about it, preach on it, or use it as a teaching tool. 2/3 of Jesus' 40 parables deal with or incorporate money. Over 2,300 verses in the Bible deal with money. It's spoken of in the Bible 5 more times than prayer, 5 more times than faith. By the way, I like interaction, so feel free to raise hands, call on out, shout in. But question that I always had is, why is money talked about so much in the Bible, yet we as Christians tend to shy away from it and talk about it very little? Thoughts? Yes, sir. Mr. Hall.
I think it's just an uncomfortable subject, because if you really think about it, when it comes to divorces, that's one of the top things why people get divorces, because of money.
Yeah. Number one reason.
Number one reason. People are uncomfortable with money. And I just put it in my heart. I love talking about it too. And I like dealing with businesses and investing and stuff like that. That way, because growing up, you know, I'll be 54 soon. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, our parents didn't teach us about that. They just taught us, you know, you get old enough, you get your job, and you get your insurance, and that's about it. You know, they don't teach about money, mm-hmm. You know, the true meaning of what money is. But they talk about it in the Bible and in its importance of it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just people uncomfortable with it. You know, even in Christianity, you don't hear the topic about money.
Yep, especially. Why else?
I think you put you put a target on yourself if you talk about money enough.
Mm-hmm. All right. It can almost be viewed as like we're always asking for money, always asking for giving. Why else?
I know for us why we didn't talk about it is because we didn't have much.
Fair enough. Anybody got a pen I could borrow, or a pencil? Doesn't matter. There we go. All right. I want you to imagine. So put yourself in the shoes where I gave you this pen. And we set you out on the street, you know, down by the Quick Trip. Do they have Quick Trip down here? Mm-hmm. All right, down by the Quick Trip. Illinois is not all bad. We set you on the street down by the Quick Trip, and I gave you 5 minutes. And I said, reach as many people for the gospel with this pen as you can in 5 minutes. Think of a number. How many could you reach? You could do the here's God, here's us, here's sin that separates us. But truly, how many people could you reach? This pen's not good or bad. It's just a pen. Flip the question. Now, don't say this one out loud. If I gave you this pen and I asked you to engage in the absolute worst sin, debauchery imaginable possible with this pen in the next 5 minutes, what would come to mind? Don't spend too much time on that, but what would come to mind? Let's, thank you. Oops, sorry.
Take your debauchery pen back.
Yep, yes. The debauched pen. Let's upgrade. Think about a phone for just a second. Replay those two scenarios. I gave you 5 minutes with the phone. How many people can you reach for the gospel? So much greater. What's the worst thing imaginable you can think of to do with this phone in the next 5 minutes? Some pretty bad stuff, right? That pen is just a tool. This phone, a more powerful tool for good and for evil. There's no moral value to it, but the more powerful it can be used for good, the more powerful it can be used for evil. Think about money now for a second. Is money good or evil? It's a tool. The love of it is the root of all evil. Have you ever seen that old equation? You know, I'll prove to you that girls are evil. I wasn't going to say this, but hey, run a rabbit trail. It's like, you know, if girls equal time and money, and time equals money, so then girls equal money squared, and if the root of the square of money is evil, girls equal evil. And anyways, I shouldn't say that. But I like math, and I liked that one until I got married. I was like, actually, they're not all evil. So thankfully, my wife's not here. But with money, oof. With money, you can use it for so much evil, which is why we are afraid of it, why we don't talk about it. The love of it's the root of all evil. We see it used poorly so often. Think about that on the flip side, though. How powerful of a tool can it be if used for good? One of, if not, close to the most powerful. This isn't exact. How many of you have seen Chariots of Fire before? I love it. It's about Eric Little, a runner, and this is not actually probably an exact quote from him, but it's the way he lived his life. He said, I believe God made me for a purpose. He was a missionary. He made me for China, but he was an Olympic gold medalist. And he said, but he also made me fast. And he made me fast for a reason. And when I run, I feel his pleasure. He used running as a tool to glorify God. How many people have you ever heard actually think about the same thing about money? I believe God made me for a purpose, to share the gospels we just learned today, to glorify God. And when I make money, I feel his pleasure. That sounds a little, but yet if that's the tool that the Lord has given you to further the gospel, shame on us if we're not using it. Matthew 25 is the parable of the talents, to the one he gave one, to the one he gave five, to the one he gave 10. Luke 12:48 is the verse about to whom much has been given, much has been required. America sent out more missionaries than any other nation in the world, probably combined ever. We are the wealthiest nation in the world. There's more opportunity here than anything. And maybe God hasn't given you the ability or the desire or the purpose of making money. But if he has, and he's given you that ability, and you're not using it for his glory, shame on us. Because we've been given more opportunity than just about anybody else. And I'm not saying to fall in love with it, just use it as a tool. And I think sometimes as Christians, we never hear that side of it, but it's very interesting. Think about the nation of Israel for a second. How many tribes are there? How many were called to full-time ministry? Were the other 11 allowed to be in ministry? Vocational ministry, right? Now, we're all in ministry, but as far as vocational ministry, the Lord called some people. He calls some people pastors, teachers to ministry. He calls other people to work. How many of you have heard the phrase, his last command, our first concern? Anyone ever heard that phrase before? What does it mean? Great commission. How do we carry it out? What's the best way to carry it out? And for me, it seems to be, what was God's very first command in the Bible? The very first command he gave. Because we always talk about the last one. What's the first one in Genesis that he gives to man? Subdue the earth. Yep. Work. Work. There's a Jewish rabbi, I forget his name, but he wrote a book, and it's basically the idea of, I think he called it the Ten Commandments of work, or thou shalt be prosperous or something. But he said, the nation of Israel, why is the average Jew so prosperous, so wealthy? Why is that culture so, in the world's eyes, successful? They view work as a moral high calling from God. It's called a double thank you transaction. When I help somebody with something, I change their brakes, I help them with their financial planning, I cut a tree down for them. They say thank you and pay me money, and I thank them for the money. We are doing good together by work. The more of it you do, the better. It's good to work. Now, there's a balance in everything, but again, just thinking a little bit differently about money and wealth. Takeaways for pastors from that, getting comfortable with the topic of money. Pastors, I didn't ask if you're millionaires. I didn't ask if you're wealthy. Is your financial house in order? Even if you have a little, the steward with five talents or fewer talents was still a good steward of it. The steward with 10 talents was still a good steward of it. The steward with one talent could have been a good steward of it, and he wasn't. Just because we have little doesn't mean we're not called to steward it. It just means God has given us gifts or abilities or talents elsewhere. But even with this, we're supposed to steward it. You're supposed to be the leader of your church, the shepherd of the flock. Is your financial example worth following? Are you comfortable talking about money? The Bible spends a lot of time talking about money. Do you? Not about giving. Yes, giving is important and it should be talked about. I kind of cringe every time. The only time I ever hear a pastor talk about money is giving. The Bible talks so much about money. It starts with work, providing for your family, wealth, debt, business purpose, business ethics. All these are forms of stewardship. If his last command is our first concern, and one of the best ways that we can carry that out is work, and we're not preaching on it, teaching on it, shame on us. And then again, tip. When you talk about giving, you should talk more about stewardship than you talk about giving. Because you're talking about the broader concept of money as opposed to just this fraction. Your words will carry a lot more weight. Do you have the ability to counsel somebody that maybe has more money than you? They're not looking for financial advice. They're looking for stewardship advice. Is your example worth following? Takeaways for laypersons, same thing. Have your financial house in order, whether God's given you little or much. This is one of my favorite quotes. It's from St. Francis of Assisi. He's Catholic. Don't hold that against him. But he said, preach the gospel at all times. Use words if necessary. Now, I think we all should be preaching words, but work is one of the best ways we've been given to show the unsaved there's something different about us. Get serious about maximizing the time you give to ministry. We'll talk about it next. I'll come back to that. How many of you have ever heard this phrase before? Time is money. Do we agree or disagree? Why?
It takes time to earn money.
Yep, takes time to earn money.
And you can't buy time with money.
Can't buy time with money.
Sorry. I have the opposite. Time equals money. Money doesn't equal time.
Gotcha. That's interesting. That's interesting. What is your most valuable resource that God's given you?
Time.
Yep. You can always get more money. You can't get more time. So we found a Chronos wealth. That's literally the reason we gave it that term. Chronos is just Greek for time. As we talk to people, are you getting the most, not money out of your life, are you getting the most life out of your money? As we're talking about it, kind of back to here, there are some individuals that God has given significant resources to. Well, then you should be using your money to glorify God. There are other individuals, they don't have much. Well, what you do have, you should be using to glorify God, but maybe God's called you to give your time to him. Now let's kind of transition. So laypersons, especially what we'll call wealthy individuals, business owners, folks that are approaching retirement, the typical questions even a pastor will get is they're worried. Financial security, do I have enough? Will I spend too much? This kind of now goes to pastors, your ability to be talking stewardship and asking the right questions, or lay people, what's your mentality as you approach finances? They always worry, do I have enough? Worried about market volatility, inflation, taxes, healthcare costs, long-term care, social isolation, loss of purpose. All those things are good to talk about. Yeah, you should have a plan that discusses those. The real question that you should be asking yourself is, why did God put me here on earth? What's my financial capacity? Is my financial statements lined up with what's important to me in life? Or is there a gap or an overlap there? Is my goal to get the most money out of my life or the most life out of my money? Would I rather leave a legacy or live a legacy? We've been blessed. We work with a lot of individuals in ministry. We speak at a lot of seminars, pastors. We're working on some books and stuff. We also work with some very wealthy individuals. And I just had a client that we inherited pass away a few months ago, 93 years old, significant eight-figure net worth. She's laying on her deathbed, hasn't seen her grandkids in years. Her son's trying to embezzle money from her. Her daughter predeceased her. Her best friends are all dead. And she's sitting there saying, I made every single right financial decision in the world, and I got the most money, but I've got no time left. And if I could go back 20 years and change those decisions that I had made, I would have, because I didn't know. I never actually sat down. I've got financial regrets because most folks are worried about running out of money. I had the opposite issue because nobody ever sat down and said, what's important to you in life? I never actually took time to say, why did God put me on earth? Maybe it's to use money as a tool. And I never then lined up my balance sheet, and I never understood my capacity. Folks, maybe this isn't you, but if it is, I think one of the best things about being a steward is understanding your balance sheet. Let me give you an example. Let's say you make 10 grand a month. Most of us, that's very, very easy to budget with. I get 10 grand a month of income from my work, from my job, whatever. Well, it's very easy to budget because I know I'm getting that every month. I take 10%, 1,000 bucks, give it to the church, and maybe my expenses are only another 5 grand. That gives me 4 grand of surplus. Maybe those numbers sound awesome to you and they're, you know, way bigger. It's the concept. All of a sudden, you've got 4 grand extra. What do you do with it? Well, I could pay off my house earlier. I could save more of it, walk away, retire earlier. I could give more. I could enjoy, I could spend more. I could have experiences with the kids. None of those are wrong, right? You've got a good financial house in order. You're making good money. You're giving to church. And so it's very easy now to quantify that. Fast forward 30 years later, you've got a balance sheet of $1.5 million. You need 6 grand a month to live off of it, and you're thinking to yourself, well, it was easy when I had 10 grand a month to know what I could do with that surplus, but now it's not a monthly income, it's a balance sheet. And for individuals, sometimes the most powerful thing that they can do is starting to look at that the same way that they looked at their monthly budget. I've got $1.5 million. Did I oversave for what I need, or did I undersave? If I only need, let's call it, now this is where you sit down with an advisor and actually they can help you figure this out, and you should. Well, if I only need $800,000 for me for my 6 grand a month, that means I've got $700,000 extra that unless I change my life, I'm going to leave it. It's going to grow 20 years from now, which is awesome. I can leave a lot then, or would I rather live a legacy? We were just sitting down with somebody yesterday. It was pretty neat. They wanted to help their kids. They're taking some of their legacy dollars and they're using them today. That same individual, they set up a donor advised fund and gave a significant gift to ministries because they understood what was on their balance sheet and what they needed versus what they didn't need. Easy when you've got a monthly income, hard when you've got a chunk of assets, but still just as if not even more important. It's kind of funny. We think of the spiritual gifts and we think of the popular ones. Prophecy, ministry, teaching, preaching. Having then gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. He that giveth. How many times do we talk about the gift of giving? How many times do we encourage it? All right? We talk about all the other ones. We foster all the other ones. This is the silent one because our left hand's not supposed to know what our right hand's doing, right? You can still encourage it and foster it without having to know those amounts. Pastors, takeaways when you're trying to shift your mindset on this. Giving is a spiritual gift. I'm not asking if you know what every person's giving your church. Maybe you should, maybe you shouldn't. I don't know. I don't care. But do you know who in your church has it? You know who has the gift of teaching. You know who has the gift of ministry, the gift of helps, You know who's helpful in the Awana program? You know who's helpful in, you know, leading the music? Do you know who has a gift of giving? If you do, are you discipling the growth of that individual's gift in the same way you would disciple the growth of someone who has the gift of teaching? If you aren't, why not? Their gift is equally as important as others. That's their way to minister. Why not? Money follows vision. No offense. Somebody walks up to me and says, hey, we need $1,000 or something. I'm not going to give it to them unless they got a good reason for it. Same thing in a church. Churches that are, in our terms, successful, have a vision. They have a mission. They're doing something or will do something with it. They're going somewhere. If you've got a small vision or no vision, money's going to kind of line up with that too, right? We just heard they were asking for, what, $8 million? They already got one point. They're probably going to get it because they've got a big vision. And believe me, that was just their probably their 20-second presentation. You give them 5-10 minutes to walk you through what they're going to do with that money, what they've done with the previous money. It's pretty cool. If you've got a business owner that walks into you at the end of the year and says, hey, I just sold my business. I've got $1 million check that I need to give. Why should I give it to you? Do you have a vision that can match that? What would you do with it? For that vision, so for the folks that are already giving it, do you tangibly communicate it? Tips, when you give out your yearly giving reports to the individuals in your churches, don't just show the money that they gave. Show the ministries that it went to. Give pictures of the kids in the Awana program. Give a picture of the missionary. Talk about how much your church gave to them, right? Whenever we do a VBS, the kids get excited because they see those buckets. They see the money, and then they see a picture of the missionary they supported with a dollar amount. As adults, we're not immune to that as well. We just stop showing people what they're actually doing. It's very easy to see what the teaching or what the Awana program is doing because it's visible, it's tangible, but yet we're not trying to communicate in the same way to the folks that are giving. Care about and foster that spiritual gift. And then do you communicate with individuals well about financial worries, opportunities? This idea that we just talked through, are you able to take individuals that come into you that are worried about that or that are wealthy individuals or that they've got questions, talk to them about that, help them steward, because maybe God hasn't blessed you with money, but he's blessed you with stewardship abilities. Are you able to foster these conversations, these questions? Do you have the ability to? Do they respect you enough to be able to have that open and honest conversation with them? For laypersons, do you have a financial purpose and vision? Do you know what your financial capacity is? Whether it's what that extra is on a monthly basis or what's extra in the balance sheet that you saved up in your retirement accounts? Do you know the difference between your lifestyle needs and your legacy? Do you have a proactive plan around those legacy dollars? Whether it's, hey, if I'm not using it for me, we see a lot of retirees that they've got money that's sitting in an account that they're not planning on spending and they're not planning on giving. It's legacy dollars. There's nothing wrong with that. Proverbs, a wise man leaveth an inheritance for his children's children. But they're investing it safely. Why? Because they don't want to take risk. You're investing that for 30 years, grow it. The Lord literally came back to the guy that said the one talent and said, why'd you bury it? Because I didn't want to lose it. If you're not planning on using it, grow it. Get busy doing something, either growing it for future impact or using it for today's impact. But don't get caught in between in the, I just don't want to lose it. Change your mentality, either use it or grow it. Don't just kind of sit here in your holy huddle and bury it, right? Have a purpose and a plan around it. And then if you do have the gift of giving, are you fostering it or are you stifling it? If you're not using it, the Lord's giving you the gift of giving and you're just waiting to find that right opportunity to fall in your lap, shame on us. The Lord may take away that ability, right? So if you've got it, use it, whether it's with your time or with your resources. All right, I'm rambling. Questions, comments, Snyder marks so far. Yes, sir. Thank you. Is that a comment or just writing down?
I'm just writing down.
Gotcha, gotcha. While he's writing, yes, sir. What's your name?
Dallas.
I like the name.
So if someone has the gift of giving, how would a pastor stifle that versus foster them?
Oof. Good question. Any pastors in the room?
I mean, I would say, like, the okay, I'll use an example of how I help foster teachers, right?
Mm-hmm.
One, you know, you have to spend time with them. You know, like, ask them what they're teaching. How can I help you communicate better? How can, you know what I mean? Like, first of all, you want to encourage, like, again, I'm talking about a teacher here, you know, like someone teaching. You want to encourage their teaching ability while also offering those areas of how can I help you even be better?
Mm-hmm.
So I would imagine you'd do the same thing with the giver, but that it does. It just seems uncomfortable to talk about. I don't know why, but it does. It just seems like, I don't know. But does that make sense?
Yep. I would say this. It's very easy when you're talking to somebody in ministry to literally just ask the question, why does God have you here on earth? Well, to shepherd the flock, to reach others for the gospel, to preach, to teach. When you're talking to a business guy or you're talking to head of the sanitation department, they make some good money, by the way. Or you're talking to the welder who's making $1.50 right now. Why did God put you here on earth? To weld? A little bit different, right? Because all of a sudden they're not thinking in their occupation. Yet if you think about, I think it's 2 Corinthians 5 when it talks about, I can't think of it. But simply the idea that, what's the passage right after we're transformed? Metamorphosis. It basically talks about your calling as a Christian, but you're using your vocation to carry out your calling. And the idea that how can you connect what God's calling them to do, to weld or to sanitize or whatever, to carry out the Great Commission. And you're not necessarily focused on their money. You're just focused on why does God have you here on earth, right? And how can you use that to reach others? One of the tools of which is money, but in the broader sense of stewardship, right? I think that's a really, really, really good spot to start. And then as opportunities open up, it's kind of funny. So I work as a wealth management advisor. I'll be blunt. We work with two groups of clients. We work with one group that typically doesn't have much money, but they've got time. And so our goal is just, hey, we're going to get cut right to the chase. Paul talks in 1 Timothy, don't muzzle the ox that treads the corn. They that labor in the word and doctrine, worthy of double honor. That's a verse about finances. And we're just saying, how can we make sure you're okay financially? So that's at least one concern that's not in your mind so you can take your time and use it full-time ministry. And that you're not ever in a position where you need a church more for the money than they need you for your ministry. Right? You can still minister at 80. You just probably shouldn't be taking a full-time salary that could be going to somebody new that's starting. But on the flip side, somebody that's got a lot of money, we're having a different conversation. We're saying, forget money for a second. Why did God put you here on earth? What's your story? You had 5 years left to live. Unlimited resources. What would you do? And it's kind of neat. They start to say, well, I'd do this. I'd help these people. And we say, well, what are you doing today? Well, I'm doing this. And we help them understand, well, your balance sheet's here. You want to do this. You're shooting for the stars, but you can't. But you might hit the moon. The problem is you're living here. What's keeping you from doing that? And that starts not with talking about money. That starts talking about purpose, right? And a lot of folks in full-time ministry have already had that conversation and that thought around purpose because they had to make a specific decision. Yeah, I'm going to give up 50, 100, 200 grand of potential yearly revenue to go into full-time ministry, and here's why. Folks that, like those other 11 tribes, were not called into full-time ministry, nothing wrong with that. God uses that. But maybe they need to start with that conversation as well, that maybe they haven't had that thought because they never had to decide whether or not they go into ministry. Now they've got to decide, well, why did God put me here on earth, and how can I use all my resources, my time, my stewardship, my money, family, location, job, to further the Great Commission, and that's a package deal, not just a giving deal. Because if you only talk about giving, people will not want to listen to it because then you just look greedy. So I don't know, did that answer your question, Dallas?
It helped a lot.
Okay.
So I think we stifled that. I was at a church 2 weeks ago where they have a huge chunk of money. They've got, it's an older church. They're not growing. They're kind of fossilizing. And I was talking to the pastor, and I said, what are you guys doing with all this money? And he said, but we don't really do anything with it. We're just hanging on to it. I know for us, when we had increased growth, it started with the pastor and vision, to be quite honest. Say, hey, this is where we need to spend money. This is our vision. For us, it was first, we want to buy this piece of land so that we have this. We think people give, and then we could see who had that gift. We did not try to pick those people off, but we gave them the opportunity to be able to use that, what you call it, legacy or whatever. And then we built it, bought a new building. And we've seen these people. And I had a guy come to me afterwards, and he said, thanks for allowing me to spend my money on the things of God. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I was maybe stifling him for a while because I didn't have vision as to where we should be headed. Maybe you've heard that phrase, if you don't evangelize, you fossilize.
I like that one.
Well, it's the truth that if you don't have vision, you're going to fossilize, and people won't spend money, and they become, there are people that want to spend money. Mm-hmm. They want to give. And so I think it starts with the vision.
Yep.
So
I've heard, I don't know what verse, but a friend of mine quotes it all the time, where there is no vision.
Sure.
Yep. We're commanded to give 10%. Like the Bible's got four offerings in it. If you read the Old Testament, it's got the tithe, the 10%. It's got the first fruits. It's got the, we'll call it benevolent, the others, helping the poor. And then it's got the free will offering above and beyond. And boy, it's a lot easier to go there. When I see, so Luis and Greta Ruppert, they're from our church. He was up there preaching. It's a lot easier to say, hey, we want to write a check when they're saying, hey, Luis and Greta need help. And all of a sudden, they've been there 2 months. They flash them up on the screen, and you see 50 new believers sitting there behind them. And they're like, we need a bigger space so we can reach more. Okay, that's easy to get behind when it's, well, you're giving your 10%, and we're just sitting on a stack of few hundred thousand dollars, $1 million, $2 million. Why in the world would I give more to that just to sit in the church's bank account? So I fully agree. You had something to add to that as well.
No, I was going to say, yeah, I mean, I love the, when you're, one of your slides said, show the stats behind it or whatever, what they're giving is accomplishing. And that's something like, yeah, I love that. I'm going to have to incorporate that. You know, hey, not just this is how many kids were saved this year, or people were saved this year, or whatever. But also, you know, here's what we did this year. We gave out, you know, helped this many families. We did this activity. And, you know what I mean? Just things like that. I think that's great.
Pastor Caleb would do that intermittently at our church. They would go off and do a mission trip and come back and say, okay, we spent this much for and bought these people church with the youth funds. Or we did this and that, and we would get that intermittent report back. And that was nice to know and hear. Other churches that we've been to have for food. And it's just like, and some of the things that he talks about, I've observed when I come back and look at it. Mm-hmm. He's also just given me a club to take back to my church to beat five guys that are looking for a pastor.
Yep. It's kind of funny. Paul talks about when he was raising funds, you know, him and Barnabas came back and gave funds to the Church of Jerusalem from, I think, was it Corinth? I forget. But several times he's raising money, and he talks about giving a report. Right? Why? So they can be connected. By the way, random bonus tidbit. My mind just went here. Think about a nonprofit. For pastors, I want you guys to think about the idea of business, not begging. Think of Paul's tent making. When we think of the most successful nonprofits, so I work with a lot of nonprofits, the bigger a nonprofit is, the worse the steward of money it is, meaning the more it sucks out every year, just the bigger expenses, the more in the red it is. A small nonprofit with one employee is only in the red 60 grand a year. They didn't make any money. They just suck 60 grand of donations to pay their staff. You've got a massive nonprofit. They're in the red 600 grand a year, 6 million a year, 60 million that they raise in donations, and they go right out and spend. There's no actual value, like a business that has a money-making idea behind it, there's no residual value behind many ministries and nonprofits. That's why it is so wonderful. Like you see these churches, Mark Morris Church, he was speaking today, it's like, how have they grown so big so quickly? I can guarantee you that daycare brings in a lot of money. How can you guys not just be begging? How can you start to create business pieces as well? Tent making that actually furthers the gospel. Paul probably used his tent making to witness to a lot of people that needed tents. Wait a minute. I've got little Johnny from the community. It costs him $90 a day to go over there for daycare, or $80 a day here with better people, people that love him and care about him. And we're making money. We can outcompete because we're a nonprofit. Let's just be blunt. So we don't have to pay taxes on that mess. The rest of the folks do. They got property taxes. They got all that mess. We don't. We can outcompete in that arena. And we aren't.
You can lower the prices because
the most of your operating accounts are already in place.
Bingo.
So that part of your expense is moot.
There is a church that I drive by a couple times a week. I almost cry when I drive by it. $15 million for that building. And it's empty 163 hours a week. It's got people there Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. Half the time the pastor's working from home. It's like, what a stinking waste. And it's like, if you can use your resources to be building, not begging, tent making, not just spending and just tiddling away money, just saying, we need more to keep on running this. We're more in the red every year. And not that you shouldn't have donation. You should as well. I'm not trying to get away from that. It's just, if you're shepherding a ministry, think about that. All right. Now, lastly, we're going to talk about strategic charitable gifting. So that's kind of the mentality, the attitude side of things. Let's kind of talk some fun skills and knowledge side. These are the takeaways if you're well off or have some resources you could be thinking about using. Or if you are a pastor, maybe this doesn't apply to you. You don't have to become an expert in this, but you at least need to recognize an opportunity. I believe the pastor should be the best connector in the church. He should know the best mechanic to go to. He should know the best tree cutter to go to, the best landscaper, the best lawnmower. Like, he should know all those. He should be in the community. He should be able to line people up with the estate planning attorney and say, hey, I'm not a CPA. I'm not an attorney, but there's an opportunity for you here. You should go check this out, right? Strategic charitable gifting is simple. How can I get a dollar to do $1.30's worth of work or $1.50? That's literally all it is. I'm paying all this tax to Uncle Sam. What if I could give that tax to church? That's all strategic charitable gifting is in a nutshell. I asked this question, folks. If you had the opportunity to take your taxes and drop them by 30% and ship that 30% to church, would you? Why not? There are tons of strategies, hundreds. We're not going to go into all of them. I'm going to hit what I call the big four, just so that you've got an understanding, know what's out there, and then find experts in your community. Hey, call me. Believe me, I like to work with people that have money. And but know these so that you can line people up and help them, right? That's how you can foster giving instead of stifling it. Connections. The first one, we're going to talk about qualifying charitable distributions. This starts with something called RMDs, or required minimum distributions. What happens is this. You've got a lot of individuals, remember, 11/12 of the population of Israel, that are laypersons. They've got secular vocations, not ministry vocations. They're full-time ministry, but a secular vocation. These folks have 401ks. They have IRAs. At least they do today now. As that money grows, guess what? Why do people have such large 401k balances or IRA balances, or why do they have those? Because they got a tax deduction on it. It grew tax deferred. They've got large chunks of money that they've never had to pay tax on. Guess who else notices that too? Uncle Sam. And he starts something called a required minimum distribution, somewhere between the age of 72 and 75, and these laws keep on changing. But he says, hey, you may not need that money, but I want to tax it. So I'm going to force you to take it out so that you have to pay tax on it. And here's the annoying thing. Forces you to take it out when you might not need it. It often forces people into higher tax brackets. Not only that, when you're retirement, your tax bracket is completely different. Not only might it charge you tax on that IRA that you took out, put you into a higher tax bracket, there's cross-bracket taxation as well. It takes other sources of income, like Social Security pensions, and it taxes them at a higher rate too. Like Uncle Sam's just, he's singing on the way to the bank, baby. And not only that, if you die and you haven't distributed it all, you leave it to your kids. Guess what? Your kids are in a higher tax bracket than you. And he just passed laws that say they don't have 50 years to take it out or 60 years. They got to take that all out in 10 and take it out fast and take it out at a high tax rate. Uncle Sam's not dumb. Well, sometimes. Anyways, an example of it might be this. I just used 100 grand as a round number. Let's say we got a retired couple making 100 grand a year. Maybe 5,500 a month, 66,000 is coming from Social Security, 20 grand is coming from a pension, and they've got a savings account that they just supplement their income in, and they're taking 14,000 out of that. So altogether, they've got 100 grand of income. They give about 20 grand a year to church. They give their tithe, they give their free will, they see some opportunities. Oddly enough, I'm not going to walk into the tax bracket. This couple pays $0 in taxes for all that income. Until, guess who just showed up? Oh, Uncle Sam. In the tax code, when you earn income, so if we got box one, do you see box 1A? You just report all of your income. When you've got Social Security, you actually report that in two different spots. There's a line for the amount that you receive, 66,000. There's a line for the taxable amount. What is that? Nobody knows. Unless you're an accountant or understand, it's a long, stinking long equation that just your tax automatically fills in. If you're not being proactive about it, you're missing out on it. And that couple, Uncle Sam comes in and he says, hey, maybe they've got a $500,000 in a 401k. They've got roughly a $20,000 RMD. By the way, you know, you've heard Donald Trump saying, hey, we're going to try to take Social Security tax out. That's not in the big, beautiful bill. Like, they can't do that through reconciliation. So if it happens, it probably won't, in my professional opinion. Maybe it does, awesome. This couple only had to take out 20 grand out of their IRA. How much tax are they paying before this? They get an RMD of 20 grand. When they go to file their taxes, they only took 20 out. Their taxable income almost went up $40,000. How does that work? We're not going to go through it. Just welcome to the tax code. That's what RMDs are doing. They're paying over 30% effective tax on that when they were just in a 0 or a 10 or a 12% bracket. They're still in really low tax brackets, but it's bringing in all this other income and taxing it. Unless, wait a minute, they do something called a qualifying charitable distribution. If you are over the age of 70 and a half and you have IRAs, every single penny of your gifting should come from your IRA. Why? Your cash is yours. Your checking account, your Roth IRA, 100% of that's yours. Your IRA, only 70 or 80% of that's yours. So here's what happens. You take 20 grand out of your IRA, you lose 6 grand of tax. Now you've got 14 grand in your checking account. You give a 14 grand gift to church. Simple enough. Is a church a taxable entity or a nonprofit? What's their tax rate? So what if the church earns that money instead of you? What tax rate are they going to pay on it? You write a check not to you. You never take possession of the money. You write it directly to church. 20 grand of giving, zero of tax. If you got retirees in your church, talk to them about stewardship. You don't have to walk. Just say, I don't know your numbers, but I talked to John, our finance guy. He said you're giving. Do you mind, are you guys giving that, just checking, or do you guys have an IRA? You might be able to save a lot of money doing that, right? There's opportunities there. Let's talk through, so that's called a qualifying charitable distribution. You just take money out of your IRA. You own 70, 80% of that. The rest is Uncle Sam's. You now give the full dollar. You just picked up 20, 30, 40% of extra giving. Donor-advised fund. Again, this is something that's typically for larger income individuals, but if you have them in your church or somebody that just sold a business, they should know about this. Let's just take a typical family. Anybody that's giving over 15 grand a year, this could make sense for, by the way. Okay. let's say they're making 200 grand of income and they're giving about that 20% level. And we're going to look at 2 years worth of tax returns. Year one, they make 200, they give 40 grand, and they've got an option. My standard deduction is 30. I can take 30 grand of tax deductions. That's just what Uncle Sam gives me right off the bat. Or I gave 40. I could get a 40 grand deduction. Which would you rather have for deductions, 30 or 40? Not rocket science. So they take a standard deduction of 40 and their income's only 160. So 200 minus 40 is 160. On 160 grand of income, the tax that they pay is 37,000 bucks. Over 2 years, roughly $74,000. Just in income taxes. Not even Social Security, all that mess. Individual number two, smart dude, says, wait a minute. You know how we have funds for our car fund? We have funds for our vacation fund? We have funds for our retirement fund? I'm just going to set up a giving fund. I still want to give every year to church. I'm not just going to drop 80 grand in their lap this year and do zero next year. But I'm just going to take some money this year, and I'm just going to put that extra money in a giving fund for next year. I'm still going to give it next year to church. But what happens? The person sets up their donor-advised fund, and they stick 2 years' worth of giving in it, this year's and next year's. That's 80 grand. They get a tax deduction for that entire amount, right? What's better, 80 or 40? 80. So now their taxable income in that year is only 120. They only paid 21 grand of tax that year instead of 37. The next year, they say, I don't want a tax deduction this year because I did my giving last year. I set up that fund. I might still take the money out of that fund and give it to the church this year so that I'm actually tithing as I'm making income, but I want to lump up my tax deductions. Kind of like you hear those folks that they pay their taxes on their property taxes. They pay them in January and December so they can lump 2 years of property taxes together.
That's what it's called, donor
advised fund or gift bunching. You're doing that. The same thing you do with your property taxes, you do with your gifting. There's a lot more pieces to this. I'm just going really high level so that you understand how it works. Okay? All of a sudden, the next year, well, they don't get a tax deduction. They're giving 40, but they're not getting the tax deduction for it because they got it the previous year. But they still get 30 grand a standard. This couple gave the exact same amount of money over the exact same period of time in the exact same way, but saved 12 grand in taxes. Hey, I can think of some fun ideas to do with that. So a lot of pieces around donor advised funds, a lot of details. We'll cover that later, or not. Gifting appreciated stock. Let's say grandma and grandpa set up a little stock fund for you guys, or you've got some money after your retirement accounts. Let's say you stick 10 grand into an account, and it grows. Like, you buy Bitcoin, baby. You're on the ground floor. And that stinker is worth 100 grand now. How much money did you put in?
20 bucks.
Yeah, 20 bucks. Let's say you put in 10 grand. How much is it worth now? Do you think Uncle Sam wants some of that money?
He does.
He does. And so let's say that you're wanting to say, I want to give $100,000, man. So I've got this sitting in my checking account. By the way, right now, if you've got 100 bucks in your checking account and you pull it out, does Uncle Sam show up with a Tommy gun and take it all from you? Or even a part of it? Not yet. Anything sitting in your checking account is yours. Might pay tax on the growth, but it's yours. So you've got 100 grand over here in your pocket. You're looking to give 100 grand to church. And it's all yours. No tax due on that money. And you've got 100 grand sitting over here in stock that you actually like. It just made 90. I wanted to make some more. But whenever you finally do sell it, you're going to get slammed in taxes. Well, what if you did this? You said, instead of giving my checking account to church, because that's all mine, what if I gave my stock to church, only 10% of which is mine, and the other 90% Uncle Sam's got it taken? What's the church's tax bracket again?
Zero.
Do they pay tax on that? I gift the stock to church. They just got 100 grand, which was my goal, right? And then the 100 grand in my checking account, I just go and rebuy that same stock. Now how much of that stock is mine? 100 grand. How much of it's Uncle Sam's?
Zero.
Right? You can even pair that with a donor-advised fund and get a double deduction. This stuff's fun. Anyways, I like money. I don't love it. I like the tool of it. Efficient beneficiary options for estates. What is your last opportunity to show your kids what's important? Inheritance. What if you set a model for them by including the church and the ministry in that? Right? They should be seeing you steward it during life. They should be seeing you steward it in death as well. We talked about these accounts that Uncle Sam's got 20, 30, 40% of it. Let's say you've got an estate, and we'll just pick a number. John Doe wants to leave his estate to his four children. He's got a $500,000 house. If you leave a house to your kids, they don't pay tax on it. Even if you bought it at 100 grand, it's worth 500 grand now, they don't pay tax on that growth. Life insurance, it's tax-free to them. Stock, here's where it gets cool. I bought 100 grand worth of stock, it's worth 500 now. When I die, my kids get a step up in basis. They get the new value of that. No tax is paid on that appreciation. So that's a really efficient asset to leave to the kids. Roth IRAs, we love these, baby. They're tax-free. Is the IRA taxable? Sure is. Let's say this individual has four kids and he wants to help his church too. He wants to give 20% to each. So he's got a $2.5 million estate. He wants to give a $500,000 to each of those. He could give it two ways. He could just split everything down the middle. Estate plan, I want a $500,000 to go to each, done. Well, then it's split up. The church receives 500 grand, the children receive 500 grand, but each person receives 100 grand. Does the church pay any tax on any of this? Because they're in a 0% tax bracket, right? What about the kids? Do they pay tax on the house? Nope. Insurance? Nope. Stock? Nope. Step up in basis, remember? Roth? Nope. IRA? Boom. You betcha. 30% gone right off the top. Uncle Sam is your largest indirect beneficiary because he just got a higher chunk of your IRA. He got it at a higher tax bracket over a shorter period of time. He inherited all your Social Security that you paid taxes on that you're not receiving anymore. Whoosh. In this scenario, you got four kids, each receiving 100 grand. You just lost 120 grand of your estate to tax. Not immediately, but it's gone. Your kids will pay that on your behalf. What if you left the same amounts, but you left it different? I'm going to leave the kids, not 100 grand of each of these. I'm going to leave them 125 of each of the tax-favored assets. Do the kids pay a dime of tax on any of this? Nope. Does the church pay a dime of tax on the IRA? I just passed my entire estate tax-free, 30% of the IRA of which would have been taxable. I just increased my legacy by 120 grand. I like talking about money. That's pretty cool stuff. So there's other options, but those are the big ones. If you have questions, you know, feel free. I'm happy to go into more detail. But a lot of other options. Big takeaways on this. Pastors, I don't expect you to memorize a tax code. I don't expect you to read through it. But you need to know who in your church has a gift of giving. You know who has the gift of teaching. You need to know who in your church is a business owner. Are you able to identify gifting opportunities? You're not schmoozing. You're treating everybody equally. But part of treating everybody equally is equally helping them with their gifts. Are you actively seeking to educate, counsel, provide resources to your members that help them to be good stewards of what God has given them and further the church's ministry and the Great Commission? Are you the connector of the church? Hey, our church, we've got an estate planning attorney that comes in once a year just to talk about the value of wills, trusts, and estate plans. Are you providing that resource to your people? Maybe have a seminar. Is your church able to accept gifts of stock? If somebody said, hey, I want to do a stock gift, are we able to accept it? What's crazy is this. Don't wait till somebody's actually on your door begging to give it to you to have it ready. Does your church have a stock account that it can accept stock? It's crazy. If I'm sitting here trying to witness to individuals, and I'm just saying, Lord, bring somebody across my path that I can witness to, there might be somebody. But if I'm actually looking for the opportunity, boy, I'm going to find a whole lot more, right? You know, because of God. Same thing happens with giving. I can't explain it. You set up a stock account, you're just looking for opportunities, you'll find them.
Got a quick question for you on the stocks. If an individual gifts those stocks to the church,
mm-hmm.
can the church hang on to that stock?
Yes.
And the capital gains would still be zero?
Correct.
Okay.
That gets into church philosophy. Is it the church's job to invest, or is the church's job to use? But that's not conversation for you today, but yes, church can hang on to it. It grows tax-free.
Okay.
Takeaways for laypersons. Do you know whether any gifting strategy can make sense for you? Do you have an estate plan? Does it incorporate gifting? That's your last chance to leave your testimony for your kids. Hey, have your testimony in your will, in your estate plan. Model giving for them and show them what's important with your last testimony here on earth. So, all right. Hey, 3 minutes early. We got time for questions, baby. Questions, comments, Snyder Marks. We flew through that, by the way. Sorry.
What was that book on with the DAF was the second one you recommended. Yep.
Qualifying charitable distribution. That's only if you have IRA dollars and are over the age of 70 and a half.
Okay.
Instead of taking that money to yourself and paying tax on it, you give that money to church. So we say, hey, take your Social Security, take your life insurance, your Roth IRAs that are tax-free. That's your money. Use your IRA that you would have had to pay tax on and would increase the tax on everything else and use that for gifting.
Okay. Yep. Let me ask you a question from this point of view. Myself, I'm in an age where I can take out from my IRA without the early withdrawal penalties and things like that. Would I be further ahead to, I'm under 70 and a half, to start taking out of that now and putting that in my pocket, so to speak, or convert it to a Roth,
mm-hmm.
or keep it where it's at now?
Great question. I'm going to fly through it. I've actually got three philosophies around that. Number one, it starts with a purpose. Understand your balance sheet. Have lifetime versus legacy assets. How much of this IRA do I need for me? How much am I going to leave? Then from there, you know, hey, maybe you've got an amount earmarked for giving. That should stay in the IRA then. Everything else then you're trying to convert. Now we get to number two. How much am I converting? You're washing your tax brackets. I'd rather pay tax on a small amount today instead of a large amount tomorrow. And then number three, you're looking for opportunities. When's the best time to go to Kohl's?
After Christmas.
When it's on sale. When's the best time to buy stock or to pay tax? 2008, worst time to sell a house. Best time to get it appraised. So you're doing planning like that. You're looking for big opportunities. So great question. Other questions?
So when you're transferring that money directly from your IRA or 401k to the charitable organization, you talked about writing a check. I didn't think most of the accounts had check writing for you. So
you have to fill out a form to do that. So with whoever your custodian is, Vanguard, Fidelity, if you ask for your QCD form, any entity that holds IRAs will do that. By the way, only IRAs. Does not apply to 401ks, 403s, any of those accounts. Only IRAs can do that.
If it was a 401k or something like that, you would have...
You roll it to an IRA, and then... Correct.
Or couldn't you... Bank transfer directly from the IRA to the...
No. You're not going to want to do it that way.
No.
Checks can be the best. Yep. We'll talk with an accountant. I won't even get into that. There's specific details as far as the functionality of that and the process, but if you have questions, we can talk more about that separately. So.
Well, that's something that I looked into a little bit once before. It could be done.
Yep.
I didn't get a very clear answer.
So, and sometimes there's a reason to leave it in the 401k. Say you're still working, that money's exempt from RMD. It just gets to keep growing. But if you're not working, absolutely. It's subject to RMD, stick it over to an IRA. So, other questions? or Comets or Snyder Marks.
No.
Oh, that's just a stretch. I almost had you. Sounds good. Well, with that, I think it is 2:30 on the dot. A lot of content. Thanks for sticking with it.